Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our virtual meeting. It is 9 a.m. on Tuesday, January the 18th, 2022, and time to convene the regular meeting of the Snohomish County PUD Board of Commissioners. I'm Toni Olson, President of the Commission. In accordance with the Governor's Proclamation 2028.15, we are holding our meetings remotely. I have with me this morning Commissioner Rebecca Wolf, our Vice President, Commissioner Sid Logan, Secretary, John Harlow, our CEO General Manager, Ann Spangler, General Counsel, Melissa Collins, Commission and Executive Services Director, Allison Morrison, Assistant Clerk of the Board, and Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board. The written record will indicate others who are present. Please remember to mute your devices when not speaking. The session is for the board and the CEO General Manager to study and discuss issues among themselves and with PUD staff. If there is a public comment request, issues among ourselves and with the PUD staff. If there is, and time remains on this morning's agenda, 15 minutes will be allowed at the end of our briefing session. Our first item is CEO General Manager briefing and study session, and I'll turn it over to John Harlow, our CEO. Please go ahead, John.
Good morning, commissioners. I hope you all had an opportunity to enjoy some of the sunshine over the past weekend. We've got a really full agenda this morning, so we'll jump right into it. First off, our community engagement update, and this morning is featuring the amazing Jeff Feinberg. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, John. Good morning, commissioners. Thank you for the introduction on that, John. I'm just going to be sharing just a few brief updates with you this morning. And the first thing we wanted to update you guys on is the holiday lighting exchange that we held out at the Monroe Fairgrounds back in December. And at that event, we were able to give out 1,500 strands of highly efficient, multicolored, and white holiday lighting. We also collected 4 different pallets of food to be donated to local food banks. And then in addition, we also had several other pallets of old incandescent, less efficient holiday lights that we were able to have recycled. We did that in partnership with Ridwell, which is a really neat company that basically does all sorts of recycling of different kinds of products. And so good partnership there. And we look forward to kind of working with them on future events. Additionally, at the Holiday on the Bay that same weekend, we were able to give out an additional 500 strands of holiday lights. And so that was really fantastic. And then kind of turning the page to a different update, you guys know that we've been working with Snohomish County and their partners that they've identified for the emergency rental assistance dollars that come from the federal government. And so we've been working with Workforce Snohomish, which was their grantee. And we've been working with them really since the grant, you know, opened up way back in February of last year. And at this point to date, we have been able to assist 1,144 families with $912,000 in direct assistance towards arrearages. And that is an ongoing process. Basically, the way it works is customers either go directly to Workforce Snohomish, perhaps they go to Volunteers of America for help with rental assistance, and then they get led to Workforce Snohomish, who handles the utility arrearage payments. But nevertheless, we work with Workforce. They send us a list of qualified customers. We get them the balance and the arrearage information that they need. They tell us what the pledge amount can be based on the rules that U.S. Treasury has set out, and then we apply those pledges. And so that's an ongoing process. We have another group of customers that are currently in the process right now, but we're really pleased that we've already received just under $1 million of total assistance, and that, you know, this work will continue to be ongoing through the rest of the year. And so we'll continue to give updates as that goes, and updates as some of these other additional federal dollars get kind of built into processes to reach our customers. And then the last comment that I wanted to make about that is what's been really fantastic about that, and you know, the work of our CSRs applying all those pledges, getting all those balances for us, is we've also identified a way to have a streamlined enrollment process with Workforce Snohomish when we're the ones that encounter a customer that might be a good fit for the need. And so we've kind of got our field and collections team, we've got our energy assistance CSRs, basically on the lookout for customers that maybe would be in threat of disconnection. And whenever that whenever we find a customer that kind of checks those boxes, we now have a direct URL where we can send them directly to Workforce Snohomish so that they can kind of get fast-tracked to see if these emergency rental utility assistance funds might be a good fit for them. And, you know, we just kind of launched that process. And again, that was developed from a couple of CSRs, knowing that, you know, there's an opportunity here, and then basically reaching out and saying, hey, can we look into trying to build this process out? And we've been able to do that. So we think it's a really neat partnership, really excited about what we've seen so far. And really that, again, there's just additional potential beyond just really sourcing those federal dollars. So, yeah, and with that.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Wonderful work.
Thank you. It's fun. Fun to problem solve these kinds of things.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you for what you're doing for our customers, and thank you for streamlining things for them to help them. So that's amazing.
Like we know, put things in the hands of the CSRs and they figure out the best processes, and they've done it again. So pretty cool work.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Jeff. It is impressive what you and the team are continuing to do. So next up on the agenda is our legislative update, but we're going to actually move that to the end of the morning session because Kim Johnson and Clark McIsaac had to take a meeting this morning. So we're going to move right into our first presentation, which is the Snowpud Wildfire Mitigation Plan, and that will be Gordon Hayslip. Good morning, Gordon.
Good morning, John. Can you hear me?
I can.
Good. Thank you, everyone. Good morning, commissioners. Yes, you recall this is going to be a follow-up presentation to a presentation I made last July on when we were in the middle of developing this wildfire mitigation plan. The plan now is basically complete. I would like to take this opportunity to thank the team that worked on this. Kyle Lagar and our generation group, Ray Ackebusch, Vegetation Management, Jeannie Harshberger, System Planning Protection, Paige Olson, Energy Control Center, and also Scott Lindsay and his team at BKI Engineering are consultant in this effort. Next slide, please. Let's see here.
Gordon, if you click on the first page of that presentation and use your arrow buttons, you'll be able to work through that.
Oh, okay. There we go. Why a wildfire mitigation plan? In large parts of the West now, there is a year-round fire season. There's no traditional fire season as it previously used to exist. Luckily, that hasn't been the situation yet in our service territory, but with climate change, we have to be, you know, cautious of that. There's also an all-time fuel load availability. Again, in a lot of the West, there's over 10 million acres of land that contain ready-to-burn kindling from 147 million trees that have been killed or weakened by drought and bark beetle infestation. And what is the situation in our service territory as well is there's a blurring of the wildland-urban interface as people build into the less populated areas, the more rural and forested areas, there is more homes, communities, and infrastructure that are in high fire threat areas. So the objectives to the wildfire mitigation plan are to protect public safety, to minimize wildfire risk, wildfire prevention and mitigation, effective communication and outreach, proactive ahead of state mandates, to document our vegetation management program, and to reduce the district's liability. And this plan, while this is, we're in our final version now, this is gonna be a living document. We're gonna be revisiting this plan every year and modifying and adjusting the plan as circumstances evolve. The plan elements consist of the objectives of the plan. There's an overview and application of the district's fire prevention strategies and programs. The wildfire risk methodology, which includes identification of our high threat areas in our service territory, identification of risks, what assets the district has in those high risk locations, prevention strategies and programs. We reviewed our vegetation management program, our T&D operational practices. We came up with recommendations for system hardening. We reviewed our inspection plans, our emergency response plan. We identified performance metrics that we're going to be monitoring to see how we're performing on the plan, and then a plan for revisiting the plan annually and revising it if necessary.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Hi. Thank you for this, Gordon. I would like, if possible, a little more information when you have it about the system hardening recommendations. I follow this very closely through some other groups that I'm following, and they're focusing a lot on the responsibilities of property and homeowners in the WUI, the wildland urban interface, and what they need to do and that they have liability to. excuse me. And so I think that's really important to educate and actually maybe even make some regulations that people need to follow if they live in that wildland urban interface. And I did have one question about, the drought and beetle infestation. How far east do we have to go before we get into that? I mean, are we already having that on the west side?
Commissioner Wolf, we're veering off. Your questions are excellent, and I know this is an area of expertise that you have, but we're veering off in terms of the track on our presentation this morning. So I suggest that we make a sidebar note on other issues that you want to bring up outside of this core presentation.
Okay, the issue is system hardening recommendations.
Yes, and Gordon?
Yes.
Can you make a note on that?
Yes, I will.
Thank you. You can go on with your presentation.
Okay. I'll reach out with some specifics on the system hardening.
Thank you.
Portion.
Thank you.
Okay, one of the first deliverables on the plan was identifying where our risks are in the district and our service territory. It started out first with identifying where we have the highest ignition potential. And as we kind of, already had explained that most of the risk of high ignition is in the east part of our service territory. And you can see this map is identified as such. They take a look at our terrain, the fuel load, climate and meteorological data, and they developed this ignition potential map. The next phase of that, though, was to take a look at the conditional impact. And this looks more at the infrastructure, housing, roads, watersheds, and what would be the results of having a fire in certain areas. And that's what this map represents. Finally, they combine the two into a wildfire risk map where it takes a look at ignition potential and consequences of a fire. And you see still the high risk areas primarily in East County, although we have some in South and North and some towards the west part of the county. We have to caution that does not mean we're likely to have a fire in the western part of our service territory. But should we have a fire, the impact would be pretty severe in some of those locations. But right now we're focusing on the high ignition potential areas, primarily East County.
Gordon, this is Commissioner Olson. I guess I was surprised to see Camino Island while it's not, it's a moderate risk, but I guess what is driving that?
What drives that is again, the potential of an ignition in Camino Island is pretty low, but there's also a pretty good reach between local fire stations. And so there would potentially be, should you have a fire there, it may take longer to get first responders in to get the fire under control. There's also a fair amount of, you know, housing, as you well know, on Camino Island. So that's how they developed this map. Again, you see also areas down in the south town.
Again, it's
the probability is pretty low in those areas. Okay. Just to be clear that, you know, a fire in that area would be pretty impactful.
Okay. Thank you.
Gordon, it would look like by looking at this map that we don't have any assets in a lot of that area in the east. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. And fires we have historically had in the past, which aren't many, have been east assets that we have.
Thank you.
So we did identify where we do have assets and where they cross the boundaries of the high ignition potential areas. And we've got basically on our transmission, 11% of our transmission crosses those high risk areas, 16% of our overhead distribution does, 21% of our underground distribution. We have 20% of our substations and 100% of our generation is in high risk areas. So the different facets we're focusing on as planning to prepare for that is obviously vegetation management, clearing around poles, removing fuels and right-of-ways when we do trimming, and right-of-way maintenance on our right-of-ways. We're also looking at our operational practices, disabling automatic reclosing. We've actually already taken that step where we have the ability now to go to fire settings on certain circuits in fire season if the meteorological conditions warrant going to fire settings where we disable automatic reclosing at the breakers. We're looking at doing more drone and infrared inspections on our lines, and we're doing increased community outreach in those areas. For design and construction, the cover is a little bit of the system hardening here. We're looking at single phase reclosers in lieu of fuses on laterals in high risk areas. Metal transmission poles, that's something we've already been doing for a number of years now, and we've gone 100% metal away from wood. Avian framing, that's another example of, these are programs we already had in place, but they're actually also very helpful for mitigating fire risk. Framing to, you know, for avian friendly framing. And underground distribution lines. Most of our new line extensions are underground nowadays. Yeah. So that's another thing that helps fire mitigation. Okay, situational awareness, coordination with emergency services, weather monitoring, the National Weather Service and weather stations at our substations, and monitoring metrics on weather. So for our inspection and maintenance programs, tracking our inspection program and GIS, we have an active T&D inspection program and an active intrusive wood pole testing program. And we're gonna be standing up a steel pole inspection program hopefully this year. And then response and recovery, critical event messaging, line patrols prior to re-energization. And this is a policy we have, a procedure we have on the operations side anyway. When we re-energize a line that has been down and out of power for a while, we run the whole line to verify that there's no other issues on the line. And post-disaster customer assistance is something that we touched on with the plan. And our next step.
Gordon, this is Commissioner Olson. I apologize. Can you go back to the previous slide?
Yes.
Vegetation management, is that expanding what we do today in terms of the frequency, or is it expanding?
We are looking at potentially doing mid-cycle trimming on the laterals and some of the circuits in those high fire threat areas.
Okay.
We have a pretty robust vegetation management program, as you know. And that, you know, that has helped that we've been able to just look at tweaking that program a bit to potentially, you know, address some of the areas in the high risk area, lines in the high risk areas.
Okay, thank you. Question two, the undergrounding, is that just distribution? We're not talking about transmission, right? It's distribution in the flats or distribution in general?
Well, we typically, it's my understanding most most residential line extensions now go underground. You know, we avoid tree trimming and tree removal in that regard.
Okay.
We have a lot of, most of our feeder circuits though are overhead and continue to remain overhead.
Okay.
Where we are undergrounding those feeder circuits is a lot of cases where the zoning has changed such that we can't, you know, get sufficient clearance in the overhead line to buildings and structures.
Thank you.
Yes, Commissioner Wolf.
Thank you. Excuse me. At least three of these areas could include the education and preparation of property owners. So I look forward to see how that's going to play into this. Thank you.
Yes, that is touched on in the report too.
Great.
So our next steps, basically, are we plan on revisiting this plan annually. We're going to update it as winds change. We anticipate that when AMI and our DA network become available, we'll be deploying more and more SCADA control devices on the laterals in those areas and all potentially line sensors to give us more situational awareness of what's going on in those areas. So this currently, Washington State doesn't mandate a wildfire mitigation plan, but California and Utah do. But it's probably going to be something that will be required by all utilities at some point in the state. And that's all I have at this time. Are there any other questions?
Gordon, it's Commissioner Olson again. One last comment. You're going to be revisiting this annually. Very important topic. And is the plan to, if there are really significant changes or needs, that you will report that back to the board in an update?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, I'm glad we're working on
that. Thank you, commissioners.
Excellent job, Gordon, as always. So next up is Brian Booth with our energy risk management report update for the fourth quarter 2021 and some additional information. Good morning, Brian.
Did we lose him?
There we go. My controls disappeared as soon as I went into the presentation again. All right. Good morning, commissioners. Thank you for the introduction, John. Joining me today will be Peter Downhauer, a principal utility economist, and my team. And also want to give thanks to Felicia and Ang, who put a significant amount of the work into putting this presentation together. So let's go ahead and jump right into it. Our standard boilerplate for these, a little bit of background. PUD staff make best efforts to anticipate both the consumption of electric power by its customers and the supply of electric power available. The district engages in transactions in order to meet the customer needs in a dependable, safe, and responsible manner. And these transactions include the buying, selling, and scheduling of electric power, options for electric power, and other energy commodities as necessary to meet load and mitigate risk. Recent meetings, we've had our slew of recent quarterly risk reports, and I did want to highlight last December of 2020, we did have our energy risk management policies and procedures workshop. All right, so a quick look at how our supply looked this last quarter. By and large, we came in at 106% of expected. It did move around a little bit quarter by quarter, as you might imagine. With December being as cold as it was, we drew on the reservoirs pretty hard during that period to meet load. So we did have a significantly higher than planned December generation. Wind for the quarter was really quite good at 117% of expected, and Jackson, particularly with that December ramp up, was also significantly higher than anticipated. We did highlight a couple of key moments here. You can see that outage that we had at Jackson at early November for the conditioning tunnel work. So you can see that generation drop offline for a period there. And then a much shorter CGS outage at the beginning of December, where they did a 9-day maintenance outage to, I believe, balance the new turbine that they installed during their refueling last time around. Fun fact, the new turbine weighs approximately 140 tons, and to rebalance it, they added 1.5 pounds of counterweights to it. So it is a precision machine they're working on out there. I imagine they loaded into a giant tire balancing rack of some kind and then hammer weights into it. That's all I can think of. All right, on the demand side, loads were up, loads were good. We put in both our budget forecast, just for your information here. So this is our long-term forecast that feeds the budget, along with our month ahead forecast that takes our most recent weather prediction for the month. And then actuals are the three rows that you see there. Versus budget, the quarter came in at 108%, or 107% versus that month ahead forecast that has the latest and greatest information. As you can see, in November and December were really quite high from a load standpoint, with December having that big cold snap, while November being just sort of a little cooler than expected across the board. You can see, particularly at the end of December, where temperatures dropped here in Marysville, they hit single digits. You can see temperatures dropping there on the right side, right near the end of the year, and then loads subsequently spiking. So focusing in on that peak week, we'll have it a later slide, but I did want to show you market prices here. Here we've graphed out in red the day ahead daily prices that we saw throughout the quarter, and in blue the hourly real-time prices. You can see at the end of the year with that big load excursion, we did see a mild spike in prices, although getting into the $100 ranges, we've seen a lot worse. I'll be just fine if it gets to that level. All right, so that peak week. The peak week is the single highest week during that quarter of load demand. Market prices are shown during that period. We have them in the bottom right of this slide. Our peak week was, as you might imagine, December 24th through the 30th, where we hit a max of 1,344 average megawatts on the 27th, and we had an hourly peak of 1,526. This was our highest hourly peak since we last saw in 2009, where we hit 1,531, and Kimberly-Clark was still operating back then, and of course used a whole lot of power. So if you think of this as everything except for Kimberly-Clark, this was an all-time peak.
Yeah.
Prices over this period peaked on that peak day of the 27th, with prices hitting $105.52 in the day-ahead market and averaging just about $90 in the hourly real-time market. As you might imagine, we were a net buyer over this period, but not too bad. It could have been a lot worse. We came out of this one feeling pretty good. All right, we also like to take a look at how our load forecast is doing. So we've graphed out how it has performed for this past year. We have the modeling error in red stacked on top of the weather error in blue. So if the weather forecast was off, and it's almost always off, at least a little bit, that would cause our model to be wrong by a certain amount. And then even after you account for that, if there's still an error, we attribute that to the model simply not nailing it the way we wish it would. A note here is that this model takes all pre-COVID data. With the stay-at-home order, we stopped loading new data into it, knowing that that was going to be tainted, for lack of a better term, and that everyone's behavior suddenly changed. However, now that we've all been in the post-COVID world for a while now, and things at least feel like they've settled into a normal of some kind. We are in the midst of updating this model now, using that post stay-at-home order data. So we think we can tighten this up significantly in the near future. All right, Allison, is Peter on the call with us?
I'm here.
Excellent. Well, with that, I will hand it over to Peter. I will drive if Peter, you'd like to narrate.
Sounds good. Let's get into our risk test here. So it was a little bit more interesting quarter than typical. Firstly, looking at our current exposure. So we have 33 approved trading counterparties. And this test, it tracks the current exposure is the cost of all the active transactions at current market prices with each of our counterparties. And you can see about 12 tests shown. I think we actually have a few more in there throughout the quarter, with the largest observation highlighted, as well as the last exposure at the end of the quarter. So as you can see, we had no exceedances for our current exposure test over the quarter. When it comes to potential exposure, so this is the cost of all the active transactions at the potential market prices in current volatility with each counterparty. We did have one exceedance at the very end of the quarter. We saw prices moving around, particularly in January, pretty significantly. And so there was one counterparty that did exceed our limits there. And so as you'll see later, as I talk through how we handle that, briefly, we halted trading at that point until that potential exposure came down. Thankfully, we didn't see prices go through the roof as would have been possible according to the model. So that prevented us from trading any further at that point. Okay, looking at our financial load resource imbalance test. So this test limits, I should say, we have limits for this test applying to our net power position, assuming slice is at P25 and our wind is at P50, our normal position. And this test says that we should have no open position allowed that's greater than a certain amount per month, quarter, year, so 7.3 per month. 16 million in a quarter, 36.4 million in a year, and 51.3 million in total for all the positions. We did have two limits exceeded in the quarter. You can see in the year in the book position. Again, I'll go into each one of the exceedances and how we handle that one. But essentially, we had some long-term length that we did our best to reduce our position within the boundaries of what we thought was feasible to do so. There was a couple other things, in particular our resource adequacy program that we had to keep in account. We can see all of those observations, like before, I should say, for the most part, were on the positive side, meaning length. We had excess length.
Yeah. So you may notice I changed the title on this one to be the bird in hand is worth two in the bush test. Just as a quick synopsis, we have a whole lot of extra power, at least on paper, out into the future, and it's worth a whole lot of money, and the market is high and volatile right now. So these tests would have us sell some of that and, get good money for it while we can.
Yeah,
and to some extent we have, as we will discuss. So there was just some limits on what we could do, what we thought was reasonable to do. Looking at the price volatility test, you'll see here there was one limit exceedance as well. So what this one does is it looks at our net long and short positions, and it applies the price volatility that we see So market as it moves around, we apply that according to a 1 week or I should say 1 day or 1 week continuation of those price movements. And as you can see, we've got some observations there. The greatest of which is highlighted in green. We did have that one exceedance in a month price volatility test. I believe it was for January. Like I said, there was a time where we were seeing relatively high prices and volatile prices in January. That happened to coincide with our counterparty potential future exposure exceedance as well. So it was a short period of time. We did what we could to adjust that position, but as we went into the month, into January, that test was dealt with just by going into the month. So next slide, please.
Absolutely.
So you'll see here that we've kind of simplified a little bit our summary of exceedances. So I'll walk through these. These are our four unique exceedances that we had. And pretty much the same information as we had last time, just a little more concisely put out there for you. So the first one to talk about was the January 22 price volatility test. That was the one I actually just mentioned there. So the scale was about 100,000 over the limit. It was resolved on the very next risk model that was produced as we went into the month, and we saw both volatility and prices come down in January. We did sell some of our surplus to reduce the risk of lost value there as well. So that's between those actions, it reduced that limit or reduced that exceedance to back under the limit. The second one is the credit limit, our potential future exposure. So this was actually 11.5 million at its highest over the $20 million exposure limit. That was also resolved on the next risk model run. So we did pause the trading with that particular counterparty while that happened. We saw prices came down. Thankfully, they didn't keep going up. Or continue their volatility. They kind of came down and settled down a bit. And so they went under the limit at that point. The third one occurred on November 12th, and this was a calendar 23 mark exposure exceedance. And it was at the maximum extent, or 400K over, I believe it's 32 million. And this was resolved finally on the 16th of December. So at first we had voted to monitor, and at various occasions we sold surplus as the market was there for it. So this was resolved on the 16th of December after that. And the last one was first noted in September 23rd, and this was our book market exposure. The scale is between 6 to 8 million as we've been monitoring it, and it's an ongoing exceedance that we have voted to monitor. We've also been exploring, as a result of that, exploring financial trading as a solution, which would offer us a way to preserve some of that physical length while reducing that financial exposure that we have. So we are going to transition to a bit of a discussion around financial trading. But before we do that, are there any questions around the limit exceedances or any of the risk tests that we did?
Commissioners, any questions?
I have none.
Neither do I.
All right. So I might just add one piece of commentary on this, is that our mission, our prerogative from the commission to the Energy Risk Management Team is to prevent a market loss that would cause us to raise our rates by 3% or more. Each of these metrics was statistically designed in order to do that. So some of these limits, you've seen the millions of dollars that we, you know, essentially allow to be at risk as we wait for these time horizons to happen. Each of those was very specifically tailored to achieve that goal. So I realize that some of these numbers just on their own might seem a little bit arbitrary. I do want to assure you they are not. All right. So thank you, Peter, for queuing this up. Financial Trading 101. We've had authority since 2008 to enter into financial trades when the commission granted that to staff. However, we have not done it, probably due to a number of reasons. It's been one of those things that would be handy to have, but not really necessary to have. Until recently, we found ourselves in a situation where it would be really, really, really nice to have it. So let me give you a quick run through of how it works and why we think it's important. So a little backstory, the PUD is almost exclusively traded physical products. Financial products are another very popular tool in the toolbox to manage market risks. They're commonly used by pure Northwest Public Power utilities. In fact, we chatted with one that uses exclusively financial trading and thought that we were the odd one for using all physical. It has a number of advantages. First of which is that it locks in prices the same as physical transactions. It provides additional liquidity, as there are a number of counterparties that prefer to use financial and some that use only financial trading. It preserves our physical length and that we are not actually scheduling the power to the counterparty. It has various credit advantages, which I won't go into the details of, but they are real. And there's also the addition of a qualified independent representative that reviews each of these transactions, which is a mixed bag, of course. There's a benefit always to having another set of eyes on what we do, but then, of course, a cost of having this person. Some considerations. There are some additional counterparty requirements, including the implementation of an ISDA, which is an International Swaps and Derivatives Agreement. It's the contract that governs these. And then there's the back office preparation and ongoing management to start entering into and tracking these transactions.
Brian, this is Commissioner Olson. A quick question on 101. Slide 14, the previous slide? Or is it, okay. All right, you were on the right, 15, right one. Move to 15, slide 15. Thank you. Just by the nature of this, is this something, I know the board many moons ago passed a resolution and the guidelines were embodied in that resolution, I think. And would this change or have the need to modify that resolution?
No, if you're referring to the risk management policy statement, which is what the board adopts, no, we believe that this is included in that, and that this authority was granted to staff in the last time it was modified in 2008.
Thank you.
So I do want to run through an example of how this works. So for example, and this is a convenient example because it's the exact situation that we're in, we have a lot of length for the coming summer. Prices and volatility are high, meaning that a lot of money is at risk if prices were to drop and that surplus power were to lose value. However, the PUD wishes to maintain enough physical resources to comply with the pending resource adequacy requirements. These are still under development, but we do expect that they will go live for the year 2023 in full. And because they're not yet fully developed, we're very leery of selling off surplus power when we might need it to comply with the RA requirement. However, because we have all this length that's worth a lot of money, we would sure like to financially protect ourselves from that price risk. So we want to go through an actual step-by-step example of how this might work. So to compare this with a physical sale, So imagine we have a physical sale today. It will be at a price of $80 a megawatt hour. So right now we're in January and we'll be transacting for July in the future. And when we get to July, we'll have an average daily index price of $75. So today, the PUD would schedule this 25 megawatts to our counterparty at the $80 a megawatt hour. And the counterparty would commit to pay us for that. 744 hours, 25 megawatts, $80 per, gets us to $1.488 million. Once we actually get there in July, that power would flow, the money would come back to us. And for the purposes of thinking about financial trades, wanted to show what the day ahead market looks like. It will be important when we get there. The day ahead transacted at 75, meaning that had we not sold that power to the counterparty, we could have sold it at the daily index, where it would have been worth $1.3 million and 95,000. So when we think of that from like an opportunity cost standpoint, we sold it at $1,488,000. Had we not sold it, it would have been $1,395,000. So we had a gain versus that day ahead market of 89,000. So we feel pretty good about selling it at $80 rather than waiting for the day ahead market and selling it then. Now, had the opposite happen and prices had instead gone up in the day ahead market, we would have seen the opposite result. We still would have transacted with our counterparty. We would have seen the $5 more expensive index price when we got there. And our math over here on the left would have been the opposite, where we sold it at $1,488,000. But had we held on to it, had we sold it a day ahead, it would have been worth $1,581,000. So we'd see this opportunity cost of $89,000 that we missed out on because we chose to sell it early. So with a financial trade, it works a little bit different, but the result comes out the same. So imagine that we'd done this financial trade and the index came in at $75. Here, we come out with the math at the beginning, but no power flows. And instead, once we get there, the PUD sells the power at the day ahead index of $75, which is worth $1,395,000 that we saw on the previous slide. And because we had agreed with the counterparty that it would be worth 80, they send us a check to make up the difference. So we were able to sell it for $1,395,000. They paid us $89,000, which brings our total revenue up to $1,488,000 right here, which matches the agreed to price that we had above. So by entering into this contract, we're essentially buying insurance from the counterparty that brings us up to the total amount of dollars that we agreed upon by using a settlement versus the daily index price. Now, commissioners, this is into the weeds pretty deep. I don't expect that this will make 100% sense. But if your takeaway could be that this is a real product, a lot of utilities do this, and the outcome is the same, I'd be feeling pretty good about this presentation.
Oh, this seems like a 200 level class to me.
It is absolutely a 200 level class.
Because I'm not understanding. I understand the physical. I think I understand the physical, which is what we do. Now, I guess I don't understand the financial. Is this like an option? Is like a put or a call or something? And how does this help us with resource adequacy? We still have to deliver this power.
Yeah, it is very similar to a put in this case. So we have sold it to them at essentially a put price of $80 a megawatt hour. And because the index price was 75 when we got there, the counterparty made us whole for that $5 a megawatt hour difference. The way it helps with the resource adequacy requirement is that we get to keep that physical power until we actually make it to the day ahead market and have to sell it, which is where the resource adequacy measures our compliance. So we haven't sold that power ahead. It is ours, and we can use it for compliance purposes.
But we still have an obligation. The obligation hasn't changed. So So how does that work?
We have a financial obligation, but not a physical one.
Oh, they didn't buy power. They bought the price of the power. Is that?
That's exactly right, Commissioner.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yeah, this is Jason Zyskowski, AGM Power Generation and Facilities. And Commissioner Logan, that is correct. And maybe one way to illustrate this is the transaction in the bottom half of the slide. We don't necessarily have to make that part of the transaction. We don't have to sell that physical power. So if July comes around and we end up needing that power, we can hold on to it, you know, and use it to serve our customers. So that's kind of the big benefit of the financial piece. And for the resource adequacy program, we have to forward show 7 months in advance that we have the power to meet the program metrics. So that's where it helps from that standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jason. And that's an important nuance is that, yeah, we do not have to sell it into the day ahead index, but this transaction is settled at the value of that index, regardless of what we actually do with the power. We could use it ourselves and still get that settlement transaction.
So it's really pretty minimal risk for on our part.
Correct. We don't believe it's any riskier than traditional physical transactions. We're still dealing with the same counterparties. They are by and large, you know, peer utilities and power marketers. The credit risk that goes along with these is no worse and perhaps even a little bit better due to some credit advantages that are in the ISDA. So we don't see any additional risk with these.
Right. I don't see what the advantage is to the counterparty. It would seem like they could potentially have a resource adequacy problem because we don't actually have to deliver any power to them.
For the counterparty, they can see a couple of advantages, one of which would be that they may not be a load serving entity and they don't want the physical power. If we were transacting with like a Morgan Stanley or a Citigroup,
oh, I see, yeah.
They don't necessarily want it. They don't want to have to go get transmission to, you know, get it or move it. They're simply looking at this as trading, you know, pork bellies or frozen orange juice concentrate.
They're speculating. Yeah.
Precisely.
Okay.
One other thing to just kind of highlight what Brian just said there is the second counterparty, you know, say there in July, if we do actually sell the power, it could be anybody. It's not necessarily the whoever we did the financial swap with or the financial trade.
Excuse me, it could be anybody. You mean within our counterparties?
That's correct. Yes. Right.
Okay.
Yep.
Not just anybody. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you for that clarification.
But that brings up a question. Can this be sold then to some other counterparty? Can the counterparty sell this to somebody else? Like you'd sell an option?
So they could neutralize their risk with us by doing an opposite transaction with somebody else.
Okay.
But they cannot move our transaction so that our credit would be on some other party. It's not like a mortgage they can sell and then suddenly we start getting our bills from a different bank.
Yeah. Seems too good to be true.
I would not say it's too good to be true, but it is a nice thing to have in our toolbox, particularly given the situation with the resource adequacy program.
This is Commissioner Olson. Thank you for the additional information on this. Helps my understanding greatly. Big picture, what do you see as possible risks for us, downsides?
So probably the only risk that I think would be unique to this is that if we were to do a financial purchase, we would not have there would not be power physically delivered to us and that we would have to go out and buy it in the day ahead market in order to meet our load. If the market simply wasn't there, if we were in like a market collapse type situation, that could cause a problem for us. From a sales standpoint, I don't believe there's any additional risk to this.
Yeah. But we could continue to do physical purchases and financial sales.
Absolutely. And in fact, I imagine that we'll still be doing the vast majority of our transactions physically, and that for any period where we might have some kind of supply constraint, we will be securing enough physical power to at least meet our resource adequacy requirements.
Is this going to affect our position in the RAP, Western Resource Adequacy Program, if we choose to be full participants in that?
No, I don't believe so.
I would say it should only help us comply with the forward showing requirements there.
Okay, thanks.
And that's kind of a primary reason for one of the reasons for looking at this.
Okay, good.
So for the benefit of our customers, I guess another way to think about this is we could do a financial sale for August. Let's pick August. And then the weather comes in 15, 20 degrees hotter than normal, our air conditioning loads go up. We don't have to sell that power that we did the financial sale on. We can keep it and meet our local customers' needs.
Yeah, that's correct. And that's one of the big advantages I see to this, especially with the volatility we're seeing in the, some of the higher prices. They're kind of driving these exceptions that we continue to see. So gives us another tool to deal with those as well and hold on to that length in case that we do need it to serve our customers.
All right. Any further questions on this one, commissioners? All right. Well, we did have a second example for a sale, but I think we've probably talked enough on this. So let's go ahead.
And that, I really think I understand it and it makes sense.
Excellent. Well, thank you. That is the best endorsement we could get out of a dense and obscure piece of our marketing that we dove into on this one. All right. So our last slide, we do have forward prices, looking at our Q3 and Q4 of 2022, which are really when things get exciting in the market with high summer demands and then high winter demands. As you can see, we've got prices graphed out on the left and volatility with that right y-axis. So excuse me, prices on the left y-axis and volatility on the right y-axis. Volatility has come down over the past several weeks, but only because prices have stayed pretty high, with Q3 in particular really being over $100 a megawatt hour for most of the quarter. And with that, I believe we're all done. Any last questions, Commissioner, before we hand it back to John and Mike for the water supply outlook?
Commissioners, no questions. Thanks to Brian and Peter for doing a very good job of explaining very complex transactions. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I do want to give all kinds of credit to Kelly Wallace, who's really been pushing through the financial trading. It's a lot of work on our end to make it happen. And it's been tried in fits and starts in the past, but she's had the initiative and willpower, I think, to put it over the finish line this time around.
Yeah, agreed, Brian. Good job on your part. And Peter's, and again, a huge kudos to Kelly and the entire team for getting this across the finish line. Next up is Mike Chapley with the water supply update. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, commissioners. Thank you, John, for the introduction. Again, Mike Shapley. I'm the short-term power trader here at the PUD, which gives me the responsibility to kind of deal with some of the things that Jason and Brian and Peter were talking about as far as forward trades out generally about 2.5 years. So today I wanted to just give a brief update. It's been almost 3 months to the day since we last met. And of course, that was the beginning of the water year. There's been significant changes since then. And so we'll just get started here. So the topics, as usual, go through the portfolio mix and then go into the water year summary for 22 so far, look at some of the generation, how it's performed, and then some of our expectations as far as weather. So as you remember, this is from 2020. We'll get an updated one hopefully for you next for 2021, but roughly 84% of our resources relied on hydro generation and water supply. So a significant amount. So this is a snapshot. We've looked at this before that shows the water supply forecast at the Dalles. The Columbia River Dalles is the last measuring point where water goes through the entire system and determines, you know, how much water the system receives in a given year. So it's still early and things have changed, but you can see really since the beginning of the water year, the green line being average, that below average predominantly because we had a very poor water year. 21 water year was one of the worst we've seen in recent, and it really took a good amount of precipitation in really October and November before we're able to climb back up to average. This chart shows as of the 8th of January, we were at 104% of average. And I'm just looking at the total water year, October through September. So just in this period of time since January 8th, our water supply forecast is now 100% of average. So we've dropped 4 points in just over a week here. And primarily the reason for that was we had a lot of rain on snow that put water through the system that was great for generation, but of course it's depleting a snowpack that you need to sustain through the whole year. Generally, we see accumulations through April, so we still have a lot of water year left. Again, changes can occur pretty early based on what happens with precip and temperature. So next, I just wanted to show you the rankings. Sorry about that. So what I wanted to highlight here was in pink, that was 104% of average, and it ranked 32nd of the water year, 49 to 22. And it's been since 2018 that we had an above average water year. You can see that the top one, 23rd rank at 110% of average. On the right, you can see just how poor the last three water years you were. And most predominantly, we looked at percent of average. And so pretty darn close to, you know, well, it was within the bottom 10 of those water years in terms of the amount of water that did not come through the system. So past 3 years have been below average. So far, it's looking good, but we, of course, have a lot of water year left to go. So this is how things have developed so far. These are, of course, the precipitation temperature departure charts. Starting from the top left is October, and then down to November, December, and then through January 8th on the top right, and then total seasonal precipitation October 1st through January 8th, the bigger chart on the bottom right. So focus on a couple different things. If we look at monthly precipitation starting in October, Upper Columbia in orange didn't start out very well, but we talked about it before in October that, you know, other than the really high elevations, snow accumulations in October aren't that great. But what you notice is the next month of November, significant amount of precipitation above 130% of average, but a big change too from the southern part of the basin, which sometimes we worry about because that's our upper Snake and middle Snake basin that provides a lot of water through the spring period. saw good results in October. But again, most of that's moving through the system because it is not falling as snow other than the upper of the Snake River Basin. November, pretty poor, below average. 79% is yellow and red is below 50%. A big mix here for the month of December. And then you can see the result of the entire water year thus far. So the upper basin of the Snake looks good. What we get concerned about are these areas of orange and yellow that represent between 50 and 90% of average. And why we care about that is once we get into the spring period, when we start expecting runoff, if there is no low-lying snow or very little in the low and mid elevations, then we don't get that runoff and it has to be supplied from Grantley and other places. So particular last year, water year 21, and the year before that, water year 20, this was problematic because we had number one, a really cold or colder than average March and April, and there wasn't much snow to come off anyway. So we'll be watching to make sure that Snake River Basin hopefully gets better. And see the amount of precipitation we've had so far to date for the water supply basin, significant amount, at least for the first 8 days. It looks like we're going into a little dry period after Thursday. Precipitation colder than average was that way significantly for us along the West Coast in Upper Columbia for December. November was the per month overall. The West part was, as Brian had mentioned, you know, cool on average, but not far off from what we would expect. And October was pretty wet as well. You may have read that October through the month of November set records of rainfall at SeaTac. So it's been a wet part of the year so far. So this is taking a look at our non-PUD resources, primarily hydro. And so it's been a great start to the year, other than with the exception of November, because we were still refilling reservoirs. The ground hadn't been saturated yet to the point where reservoirs could fill easily enough. And so actually in November, the amount of average generation that we received from our non-PUD resources hit a new low, 2012 through 2020. When you look at the past 5 years, we've had some pretty bad ones. Five was pretty good. And like I said, really poor last year. But recovery happened in November, and we actually went from having a new record low to a new record high. So significant amount of generation in the month of December. And we're also looking at January as being probably about the same, close to a record high in terms of the amount of generation that we're receiving from our non-PUD resources. Planning going forward, things look great. Nothing like the past 3 years. We've seen non-PUD resource generation, particularly last year. And I shouldn't say not so good. February was actually decent in other years other than that. We believe that we're going to have more generation than what's forecasted here right now because of some new information about drum gate maintenance that I think we've talked about before. It appears that there's sufficient water for drum gate maintenance. And so we'll be acting coolly down below a certain level, allow drum gate maintenance to happen, which means that water through the system ends up as generation. So we expect an increase in February. March is kind of the outlier right now. It's one that we believe that we're going to get to average water, probably better. It will depend on the temperature and what we start to get runoff in March. Sometimes if it's warm enough, it'll stay in the mountains. If it's cool enough in that March period. Next, our PUD hydro. So our run of river small hydro has been performing really well. We had a couple hiccups with some maintenance, and actually because it was so cold in December, we had the generation out of service for a period of time because of icing. But other than that, you would expect with all the water we've had that, the generation there has been good. The Spade Reservoir, again, because things change so rapidly. When I gave this presentation and finalized it last Tuesday, we were still in a state three, which means that we have discretionary generation. We're now in a state where we do not have discretionary, we're full output because there is a probability of spill. So that's how quickly things can change again. And it's a reservoir up there that in just a matter of week can change dramatically, and it has. So we'll be getting good full generation from that for at least this month and expected through the month of February, where temperatures are expected to be cooler. So far this year, year to date, 110% of average on generation, and precipitation about 125%. The snow accumulations up there has changed as well because of the wet and warmer weather that we've had just recently. That snow that was 150% of average back on the 8th of January is 130% of average.
Excuse me, Mike.
Yes.
When you said there's probability of spill, are you talking about on the Columbia?
No, I'm sorry. This is just our own PUD hydro resources.
I wasn't sure. So probability of spill here. Okay.
Right, at the Jackson
okay.
hydroelectric plant, and specifically Spade Lake.
All right.
Yeah. And as a little side note, you know, obviously there's a lot of hydro generation within the Columbia River system, and it is, projects do spill there occasionally because you have to move water through the system, and one project may have generation that's out of service, but you got to continue to move that water through the system. And here's our favorite chart, which is the ENSO model that just predicts where sea surface temperatures are expected to be. And the reason we look at this is because over the years, La Nina and El Nino have tended to be one way or the other in terms of precipitation and temperature departure for the Northwest. And in La Nina years, which is forecasted now to be for this rest of this winter and into probably March, April, May, is that there is expectations of wetter or above average precipitation, below average temperature, which we certainly have seen so far. Going to go into a phase here where we're going to be mostly normal in terms of temperature and about average to below average precipitation, but that can certainly change in a bit. And Commissioner Wolf, I do have a piece for you here that will give you an indication of
all these acronyms. Yeah. That's great.
And again,
thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Sea surface temperatures are just measured by degrees Celsius anomalies in a region called 3.4 near the equator. And so anytime that you have a model run that exceeds minus one or positive 1 degree, it's either going to be considered a El Nino or in the case of negative La Nina type of season. And what we're really looking for, of course, is just trends. And so you can see that this consolidation line or statistical average is showing that trend. Outlier like this, I'm probably it for some sort of an error. I think that's the NASA model, but not quite certain. Just assuming that's an outlier. Next, so recent La Niñas that we've had, if we're above average or average to above average slice generation in the winter, and we certainly have seen that so far in the months of December and January, expected in February as well. So if you look back at water year 17, that starts October of 2016, you can see these sea surface temperatures are negative. And the same is held true for water year 18, which started in October of 2017. And you can see that we've got even cooler water temperature anomalies from last year. And the part that of course you worry about is when things don't generally go as planned. Remember I said that in most cases we have sea surface temperatures that are negative that would produce above average precipitation. We did not have that last year for water 21. Although as we got into the spring, we did have much colder than average temperatures. So it always doesn't follow on what we expect, but it really has to do with how this polar jet stream and the Pacific jet stream hit our part of the Northwest really, and the water supply basin. And lastly, I believe this is just the forecast February through April. It's a bit dated. This is official forecast that NOAA puts out once a month. And so this is from December 16th. We get our new forecast on Thursday, the 20th. So it'll be interesting to see if this February through April period is still expected to be below average sea surface temperatures. February has been forecasted to be the coolest in terms of anomalies from normal. We'll see if that still holds true. We've certainly seen some cold Februarys in the past, notably it was 2019 when we had a lot of snow and a very cold month of February. So I put together this. I think I will put this and leave this in future presentations. So this is just a glossary of some of the most commonly used in the water supply update. And so I'll probably leave that there for future presentations to refer to. And then lastly was just the glossary for the abbreviated model runs that we showed on that ENSO, on the ENSO forecast.
Any additional questions? Commissioners, do you have any additional questions or comments?
I have none. Thank you, Mike.
I have none either. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Great job as usual, Mike. Next up is Brent Wood with a water retail rates update. Good morning, Brent.
Good morning, commissioners.
Morning.
So I'm going to go through, if you remember at the December 7th meeting, we went through kind of the background of the water system, talked about the historical and projected water system growth and demands, historical operating results, rate drivers, including wholesale costs from City of Everett and cross-charge costs from the electric utility, and ongoing capital improvements. So went through a lot of that. Kind of boiled it down into an overall revenue requirement. Then we went into cost of service and talked about how the cost of service for single family houses versus commercial industrial, that there was a discrepancy there, and that the commercial and multifamily homes should pay a little bit more. It kind of went through the cost of service. Then we talked about the potential for different rate design options. But since the model wasn't updated with, and we were, you know, by December, it wasn't updated with what was kind of a year-end, more accurate result for cash on hand or rent revenues at the end of the year, took a step back and kind of re-looked at the model based on a more accurate representation of 2021 year-end results. There we go. Well, to me. So if you recall, at the last presentation, overall revenue requirements was roughly 2.25%, kind of moving forward, with, you know, the bills going up, for an average bill going up about $1.07 in 2022. And again, we're only talking right now through this entire presentation and before, really only talking about 2022. Anything beyond that, 2023 through 2026, is a best forecast that we can provide. But we won't be coming to the board asking you for multi-year rate increases. Only 2022, just giving you an idea of how that might fit in. So this was the December 7th. This is where we're at. We went back again, updated the a couple things on the model. One, we updated the year-end results. But the other thing we did is we looked at the assumptions as far as the fiscal targets and how conservative we were being. So in that model, we were looking at roughly, our cash on hand, that is our minimum fiscal target, is 90 days cash on hand. So for us, that's about $2.7 to $3 million in that range, the 90 days cash on hand. The model, we were a little bit more conservative, about 30% above that. So about 117 days is what we let the model get down to. So kind of pushed back on that and pushed it a little bit less conservative to closer to the 90 days. And I'll go over some of those guidelines and some of the conversations that John and Scott and I have had over the last couple of weeks moving forward here. So one of the things, as far as, again, updating kind of year-end costs, looking at the difference in revenues, we had a warm June, so our revenues were up. We're about $1.1 million up in revenues. O&M expenses were a little bit down, so that's kind of overall about a $1.3 million positive. Our distribution system charge revenue, so new connections, one of the new connection charges we have, was down about $200,000. And then capital expenses, we looked at capital expenses, not just year-end capital expenses 2021, but we have quite a bit of capital work that is in the process. It's been designed, it was in the permitting stage, it was basically ready to go. So that carryover into 2022, looking at both those years, really it's about a positive $600,000. So overall, year-end balance roughly is around $500,000 in the positive, which does make an impact. So again, one of the things that John and Scott and I had a lot of conversations about, how conservative should we be going into this, with the model, as far as the fiscal targets, as far as, where we should let that minimum cash on hand kind of target hit. And one of the things that we agreed on is that for the next 3 years, although the water utility doesn't have the same potential market volatility that the electric utility does, there's still risk moving into the next 3 years with what's going on. We're seeing capital construction costs go up. We're seeing material costs go up. We're seeing, some of those same things. Our rates are locked in, with the city of Everett, unless something changes there, through 2024. So we don't have that bigger market risk. So we felt comfortable saying that, again, our days cash on hand is 90 days cash on hand compared to the electric utilities, 120 days minimum cash on hands. But we felt good at saying about 20% over that for the next 3 years. So around 108 days cash on hand, kind of modeling that. And then debt service coverage, our minimum fiscal target for debt service coverage is 1.75. So we've tried to, make the model, see how far we could push it to kind of hit those targets. And then looking at, again, the only thing we're looking at right now, again, is 2022, 2023 through 2026 is just what we're thinking it might be, but these guidelines. So one of the things that we also did is we split out kind of the PUD rate component versus what we're estimating the Everett pass-through to be. So you'll see in the line, Everett pass-through is roughly between 0.4 and 0.6%. Now, that's not to say that their rates are 0.4, it's just that's the impact of their proposed rate increases moving forward is about 0.4 to 0.6 to our retail rates, if that makes sense. So overall range of rate increases that we felt was reasonable for this year, I'm trying to think, keeping it at about a 1.75%, outlying years, 0 to 2% for our component, and whatever the passer is. So somewhere between 0.5 and, maybe 2.6 would be kind of the range that we would feel comfortable with. But again, all we're talking about today really is 2022. So we went through a lot of different scenarios. We looked at a lot of different runs, including some runs where we thought about just doing a pass-through 1 year on the even years, odd years, doing kind of that makeup. You know, the unfortunate part is that I think everyone agrees that small incremental kind of consistent increases is more palatable for our customers. It's what our preference would be. You know, on those even years, what would happen is that the model would show that we would need a higher, you know, closer to like 4.4%. And so this is just one scenario. Again, all we're talking about really today is the proposed 2022, 1.75%, which is what we're coming to today. There is, and I just found out this yesterday, so there was an error on this slide actually. So the 0.64 is actually 0.83. So the difference in the kind of the average bill, if you just pass through a 1.75% rate increase across the board, it would be about 0.83 cents. Now, if you remember, we talked about COSA. So in slide 8, we'll actually talk about what the potential in 2022, what the potential increase, what they would be looking like for single family versus multifamily versus commercial. But that is an error. We can either make that a change at places, but again, I thought just talk about it, let you know. We would plan to be coming back to you if you felt like this was something you wanted to move forward with, and a full kind of public hearing with where we'd wrap everything from December 7th meeting, you know, all the rate requirements, the drivers, together with this recommended rate scenario. But I mean, what our model is showing is basically, you know, in the next 5 years, this 1.75 and kind of low twos is what we'd probably be looking for. But again, just looking at 1.75 for 2022. And again, the thought is that for the first couple of years, trying to keep a little bit more cash on hand, so that 108 days, which is, you know, for us, 108 days is roughly around $3.3 to $3.6 million cash reserve and sitting there, just because there is some volatility right now. So if you recall, when we looked at the COSA, last time, we were looking at a 2.25%, but then the COSA would decrease that amount for the residential, but put a little bit more load on the multifamily and commercial. So in that case, if we were to look at the COSA with a new idea of 1.75% overall revenue increase for 2022, we were thinking, you know, 1.5% to the residential, followed by the 4% for multifamily and commercial. We really didn't want to go over the 4%, so that's kind of how it overall worked out. And then, you know, one of the things we talked about actually in March was when we were going over, was it March? When we were going over the water system plan update, was the concept of conservation rates. And, you know, I think the thought was, you know, right now it'd be really tough with the AMI project and what's going on in the system right now to try to implement that sort of rate design in 2022. It also kind of makes sense that, you know, a huge driver in conservation is having our customers be able to know exactly how much water they're using. So having the AMI project in place, and then maybe think about, you know, how could we look at a conservation rate in the future? So, you know, maybe going through in 2023, 2024, talking more about that. But again, today, 2022 is really all we're talking about.
Grant, along that line, is this a proposed increase to the monthly customer charge or to the commodity rate or both?
It would be to both. So I'll show you. So if you look at, you know, again, just the green highlight at 2022, the single family customer, you know, we're talking about a 1.5% bump. So the average bill, this is a bill for 7 cubic feet or 7 CCF, which is 100 cubic feet, would go from around 4762 to 4831. So it's that 1.5% to both the fixed and commodity charge moving forward. And then again, you'll see that, so that's the 0.69, that's based on the 1.5% for the multifamily and commercial, based on the 4% pass through. Low users for multifamily, about $2 a month. High users, about $6. Commercial, around $4 to $10 for the high and low users, or the other way around. And again, just to show what, you know, looking forward, you know, if we were to, you know, if the model turns out that it's perfect and everything lines up the same, and we're still hitting the same year-end cash and needs, roughly moving forward at that 2.15%, be looking at for the single family home, which is the majority of our customer base, you know, roughly a dollar a year, or dollar a month, you know, each year, kind of adding on to that. But again, really all we're focused on is 2022. We'd be coming back to the board with revisions, year-end balances, and looking at, you know, if there is a need for future rate increases.
Brent, this is Commissioner Olson Oaks. On this slide, can you give me for commercial average user, identify what that might be in high-end user?
So, you know, we looked at our commercial customers, and, you know, our typical single family home uses about 7 CCF, so 700 cubic feet a month, in that range. Our typical commercial user uses about 30 CCF per month. So roughly, you know, four times what a single family home user would use. So the average commercial, their bill is around $147. The high user is about double that, so about 60 CCF. So their bill, you know, roughly $244 right now. It would go up to about $254 in the future. So we tried to split it out to the average user. And then because there is quite a bit of range, you know, like commercial users, some might have a lot more irrigation, others might not. So uh-huh. Tried to split it out between a low commercial user and a high commercial user, and then the average, just to get a feel for, you know, what the difference is for those customers would be.
Brad, Tony again, what in our water service area, can you identify the type of business it would be for the high user?
Sure. So some of the schools are higher with the irrigation. We have some camping clubs that are higher users. Those are for the most part the bigger users.
Hey, commissioners, while you're thinking about questions, if you can hear me, nod your head at least. This is Scott Jones, district CFO. I just wanted to add a couple of quick comments while folks are thinking. I think, you know, it's important to reiterate a couple of points that Brant made. I do think we like the idea of a slightly more conservative posture on working capital. We had a big conversation about that on the electric side back in December, just about a lot of the supply chain risks and market risks and things. In my opinion, I don't think water shares the exact same risk profile. So perhaps not quite as conservative, but we do kind of like that idea of being in that 15 to 20% extra working capital range right now, at least for the near term. The other thing I just wanted to mention too is we do need to keep in the back of our mind that there is definitely upward pressure on, you know, from an inflationary standpoint. We're seeing that, we're all reading about that in the news. We have every expectation that the Fed is going to increase rates over the next 2 to 3 years. We think there's upward pressure on bond rates.
Yeah.
The water utility has a pretty intense capital project program coming up over the next several years that will certainly would like to fund that with cheap bonds. Yeah. But if the bond market moves away from us pretty drastically, then that definitely comes back and puts a little pressure on usage rates. I agree with Brent, the focus is 2022 right now, but let's just remember in the back of our minds that we really are unfortunately seeing upward pressure indicators in a lot of different places right now for the next 2 to 3 years. And obviously we'll be keeping a really close eye on those and we'll be adjusting and shifting gears as we need to. But unfortunately we're not in a place right now where we're seeing a lot of downward pressure. We're seeing, unfortunately, a lot of upward pressure in a lot of different pockets.
Does that indicate a need to go out and sell bonds sooner than we would have planned?
We may, Commissioner Logan, that's a really good point. We kind of did that on the electric side this past year, where we had a placeholder of about $60 million over the next, in three tranches in the next 3 years. We ended up front loading it a little bit more because rates were pretty advantageous. I think we can definitely treat these bond placements as placeholders for now. I think between Brent and I and Jim, we'll be looking at the market here over the spring and summer. And if we see an opportunity to get some benefit out of the market before it jumps up, I think we've got that opportunity. We can be pretty flexible there. Obviously, we want to balance that against borrowing too soon, right? You don't want to borrow too soon because you're going to be paying that in some way. But yes, you're absolutely right. That's the timing of those market hits is something we'll be paying close attention to. And if Jim Herling is on the call, he obviously can add to that if he needs to. But yes, I think timing is one we're paying close attention to.
Scott, this is Commissioner Olson. If we were to go to the market earlier, what is the time frame that those capital bonds that we have to use it on capital projects? Is it like 2 years or 3 years?
Yeah, let me invite Jim to jump in here too. I'll give you the really high level, but Jim can give you some better details. We typically have the ability to come to the commission and say, hey, we'll look back for a period and then we'll look forward for a period when we do a bonding, and we can repay ourselves for a certain period, in hindsight, and then we can pay for certain projects going forward. So we'll have a little bit of flexibility on that, but we do have to earmark those bonds for particular projects. For particular compliance issues. We can do a lot of other flexible things too. We can delay repayment for a period of time in order to ease a little bit of pressure, but of course interest still accumulates. But let me, if Jim is on the call, he's more than welcome to jump in here. He can give you some perspective on it as well if he's here.
Yeah, good afternoon, commissioners. I am here. I can't see my camera button, so I don't know if I have the ability to turn on my camera, but can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. To your question, Commissioner Olson, typically we have a 3-year spend down requirement on bond proceeds. So any bond issuance that we did, we'd have, we would expect to have a 3-year spend down. There are workarounds to that, and there are ways to navigate through that if that isn't the case. Typically, though, we do like to have a good capital plan to present to the to the underwriters, to the rating agencies, that we do intend to spend that money within that 3-year time frame. To Scott's point, we are seeing a lot of upward pressure on the supply chain. There's inflation, there's supply chain issues, there's labor shortages, that we're trying to navigate through on the supply chain side. Historically, we don't want to borrow too early. We don't want to, even if interest rates are good, we try not to speculate on where they're going to be next year. But clearly, all of the messages that are coming out of the Fed right now are they're going to, slow down their quantitative easing. They're going to be raising the Fed rate, which has a direct impact on the interest rates that we pay when we go to market. So happy to go into any additional detail that, that the commission would like to hear about.
This is Commissioner Wolf. I would be interested in knowing how the water business is the water business going to be charged when the payments, when it's necessary to pay for the the change out of the water meters to the Connect the AMI program. How is the water business going to be bearing the cost for those, or are they?
But Commissioner Wolf, yeah, this is Brantwood. If you remember, we came to you, I think it actually, that one was the one that was in March, talked about the AMI project and whether or not it made sense for the water utility to move forward with it. For the water utility, it's about a $12.4 million investment changing out those meters. And, you know, so the labor to change out the meters, costs of the meters, you know, our fair share of some of those costs. But, you know, a lot of the backbone infrastructure is being built by the electric utility. So it really is, you know, a good time, a good fit. You know, our meters, you know, I think over 50% of our meters are over 20 years old right now, because we've been kind of in this yeah. mode of kind of waiting to see what's going to happen as far as AMI and the next steps.
Okay, thanks. Thank you for that.
This is Commissioner Olson, Brent. A follow up on that. I thought that there's capital work in that, is there not? And I thought that was going to be a part of a debt issue.
Yeah, so if you look at, you know, I did bring up, thanks Jim and Scott, as far as the debt issuance work. I did bring up the slide that shows what we're kind of anticipating in the next 5 years for debt issuance.
Okay.
And again, so next year, about $16.24 million. But again, like Scott said, it may make sense to maybe we do that early, maybe we do that late. And some of the things that really supports is the AMI project. It's a big lift, all the material costs for those meters and the installation costs. But we still are maintaining our ongoing capital replacements for our failing your old infrastructure, water mains, still trying to keep those going too. So, you know, based on the capital, based on all the assumptions that we feel pretty confident right now, this is kind of what it lays out to as far as the debt issuance. But a lot of things can change. And as Scott mentioned, if the rates start going wonky, we might have to change things around and rely more on rates, less on debt, or maybe we can rely more on debt and less on rates. So any other
Grant, this is Tony again. I'm sorry, I have another question. Oh, did I interrupt someone?
No, that was me. I was just asking if anyone had any questions.
can you help me? I heard three different numbers, but you're reducing the days of cash on hand. Is that from 117 days to 90 days? Or so, is that 108? I couldn't follow.
Yeah, I'm sorry, a little confusing. So when we talked to you on December 7th, there were a couple things that we thought needed to be updated in the model. You know, one of those was just making sure that the cash on hand at the end of 2021 was as accurate as possible. So we've been working on this model for, you know, quite some time. I think the estimates were from June or July. So we thought, okay, we're in December already. Let's make sure that the model has the most current cash on hand numbers. The other thing that Scott and you know, we talked about was the cash on hand and are we being too risk averse? So in the model, we really showed about a 30% kind of buffer over the 90 days cash on hand. So John and Scott and I really talked about what makes sense for that. And again, the risk, some of the same risk exists for the water utility, but not all of them. The market risk really isn't there. So we're comfortable with the 90 days cash on hand, but we thought it made sense to have a little bit of a buffer. So that's where the 108 days comes in.
Oh, okay.
To answer your question, 117 is more conservative. It was what it was in the model when we talked to you on December 7th. Right. Now it's pushed down to 108 days for the next 3 years, dropping down to 90 days out.
Thank you for that. Didn't follow that.
Sorry. Let's get confusing.
Commissioners, do we have any other questions before we move on to next steps?
No, thank you.
Evening.
So if the board is supportive of, you know, the 1.75% overall revenue need, applied with the COSA, it'd be 1.5 for single family homes and 4% for multifamily and commercial. The next step would be to kind of pull everything together. So pull everything we talked to you about on December 7th, you know, the overall water system requirements, the rate drivers, all of those things with this kind of this latest look for a public hearing, you know, at the February 1st commission meeting. If you still are comfortable with moving forward with 2022, then the next step would be February 15th. We come back to you with a resolution authorizing the water utility retail rate increase. And then it would take effect April 1, 2022. That would give Scott's group enough time and IT enough time to actually implement the new rates in the system.
So commissioners, are we in agreement with the proposed next steps?
Yes. I'm supportive, and I really appreciate sharpening the pencil on this.
Yes, I support.
Thank you. Well, before we move on to our next briefing item this morning, commissioners, do you want to take a 5-minute break?
Very much
so. Or move through the morning? Beg your pardon?
Very much so.
Okay. Well, it is now 10:47, and we will take a five-minute break. Thanks. Commissioners, it is 10:52, and we will reconvene our morning session. Turn it back over to John.
Okay. This is just for any questions that you all have on the legislative information that was included in the packet. We have, again, our amazing GR team, Kim Johnson and Clark McIsaac, here to answer any questions.
Commissioners, do we have any questions?
Looking, I don't think I have any.
Oh, okay.
I don't, but I just have to say how much these are so valuable, the way they're presented, and all the supplemental documents. I always read the letters that come from RPD. And so, no, I don't have questions. I don't, at this point, I don't think I had any, but thank you.
I do have a question. I just can't find the one I'm looking for.
Oh, well, that's Commissioner Olson. While Commissioner Logan is checking his notes, I just, not the federal report, but is there anything of substance that has changed? We're really early in the state session, but have you seen any movement?
Good morning, Commissioners. Commissioner Olson, are you asking about a specific bill? And I'm sorry, I didn't.
No, just in general. Just in general, does something pop out to you? My guess is it's too early in the session to even ask that question.
I think it's fair to probably say it's always too early and always too late to ask that question. To be a little more direct, there's definitely some movement on bills that seem to align with the governor's list of priorities that was laid out in his request budget and request policies earlier in December. So that definitely does include some of like the building decarbonization bills, there's at least discussions revolving around that. For example, HB 1767, which we reported on, has received two public hearings just because there is not quite enough time to fit it into one. So, you know, there are discussions going on around some of these bills, but I do think it's probably a fair assessment to say quite the direction and momentum that some of these bills will take and will have is it's a little too early to say with a good amount of certainty.
Mr. Logan, did you?
Yes, I figured it out.
Okay.
So it's on the electrification bill or the targeted electrification. Is there any move to change that part of the state constitution about fuel switching, and does that run into this bill or these electrification bills?
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner. It's a good question. I'll say a couple of things. There's a range of perspectives on the relevance of the constitutional provision you're talking about, related to targeted electrification. Whether or not it really is relevant in this issue or not, or to what, if it is, then even to what extent it is relevant. In the discussions around the legislative efforts specific to 1767, as well as its companion, at least as far as I've heard, there haven't been direct discussions to try and address any of those constitutional concerns where some folks do have those.
Thank you.
And this, Commissioner Olson, I want to concur with Commissioner Wolf. The supplemental information to the basic report is really interesting and really shows that our folks are on top of stuff and providing input. So kudos. John, do we have any other items?
Nope, that is it.
That's great. Well, it looks like that we do have time to take public comment. And for those that are on the line, if you would like to provide public comment, please indicate you would like to speak by clicking raise hand or joining us by on phone by dialing *9. Allison, do we have anybody in the queue?
We do. We have Gayla Shoemake.
All right, wonderful. Good morning, Gayla.
Good morning, Commissioner Olson. Thank you. I'm delighted to be able to speak with you in the morning instead of the afternoon because I have two other meetings. Thank you very much. I want to let you know that members of my two groups have continued to ask for reassurance that the PUD is clearly preparing for an increased electricity production to meet the increased demand when natural gas is diminished and electrification increases with electric cars and appliances, and also the possible reduction of hydro because of climate affecting the amount of water available. Is it possible that you all could send me something that I could give to them that would help them understand it? The plan that you have given me before does not convince them that you are serious and that we are serious about preparing for this future. And it's not tomorrow, but it's coming, and they're very concerned about it. So if there's anything you could send me that I could give to them, I would really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Gayla. Allison, do we have anyone else in the queue?
We do not.
So it is 10:58, and this meeting will be recessed, and the regular meeting will reconvene virtually at 1:30 p.m.